We are Harvard Ventures, and this is The Bottom Line, a podcast about entrepreneurship, innovation, and everything in between. I'm Alex, and today we are speaking with Deep Nishar, the Senior Managing Partner of the SoftBank Vision Fund. After graduating with honors from the Indian Institute of Technology in 1990, Deep pursued his master's in electrical engineering at the University of Illinois, and later received his MBA from HBS. While at HBS, Deep founded software company Patkai Networks, but was soon recruited by Google as the Senior Director of Products, where he spent the next 6 years. Deep then spent another 6 years as the Senior Vice President of Products and User Experience at LinkedIn. Moving on to the next chapter of his life, Deep began lecturing at the Stanford Business School and joined SoftBank as their Senior Managing Partner of the Vision Fund. He has since led 36 investments, including 8 IPOs, 2 M&As, and 2 SPACs. Now let's get to the bottom line. What does it feel like knowing that you've come full circle? Can you reflect back a little bit on your journey from entrepreneur to advisor, from student to teacher?
So I don't think I've come full circle necessarily. I think life continues and it's a continuous circle. Even as I became a teacher, my journey of a teacher was more of a student because, you know, as anyone who teaches knows that you need to understand and relearn the materials a lot more and with a lot more depth than you would when you were a student. And the same thing is true of, going from being an entrepreneur to going to becoming an investor, because as an investor, I have to understand the minds of multiple entrepreneurs and not just what I was doing in my own venture as an entrepreneur. So I think it is a continuous process, and that's what I love about, doing what I do, which is I'm an tremendously curious person, and the work that I do just stimulates my intellectual curiosity tremendously every day. I know you had Bob Langer on your show, when I was in Boston a few weeks ago, this was my afternoon. I had lunch with Vicky Sato, who used to be a professor at Harvard Business School, but ran R&D for major pharmaceutical companies and is just a stalwart in the field of medicine. Mark Merkel, who was the CTO of Vertex and then founded Relay Therapeutics and now works with several other companies and is a scientist par excellence, and ended my day with a cup of coffee with Bob Langer at his home. I couldn't ask for a better afternoon to spend, and that's the story of my life. Like, I get these afternoons pretty much every week. So it's an amazing time for me to be in my profession.
What were your key takeaways from your time at Harvard? Were there any particular classes or professors who shaped who you are today and your path?
I was at Harvard at a very unique time. This was 99 to 2000. So for a technologist like me, when I first got to Harvard, it felt like my opportunity cost was massive. Like, why was I not doing my startup or working at a tech company in the Valley as opposed to like coming and spending 2 years listening to people who, may or may not have ever been a technologist or an entrepreneur in their life. But as I reflect back during my time, and look, I got very lucky. Every single professor I had was phenomenal. I invested a lot of time in getting to know them alongside my peers and my fellow students. And that reaped a lot of very rich dividends for me. I'll give you like maybe 3 takeaways that have kind of stayed with me and have really helped me through my life. The first one was a professor, I don't think he teaches there anymore, Professor Hightower, who taught us management. It was a required curriculum class. And he served, he used to be the president of Euro Disney, the CEO there. He served under President Clinton. So just a varied and very rich experience. And, and of course, in every HBS case study, the question is, what will you do? And people would always hedge. They'll say, well, if I got more data, this is what I would do, and so on. And one day he just like shut us down. He said, look, you will get paid to make decisions with very minimal information. If you have even 60% of the information that you think you need to make that decision, you are in a very fortunate place. So don't ever say, I need more data or more time. Tell me what your decision is given what you know right now. And that's what you're going to get paid to do. And that is so true. We always operate with incomplete information. Understanding, you know, how incomplete that information is, and then having a mindset that as new data comes in, you are willing to be flexible and adaptable as to your decision making, makes for a very successful, you know, entrepreneur or investor or any other pursuit in life. So that was one. Another one I'll share is Professor Michael Porter. And, you know, he came out of a 10-year teaching hiatus to teach us competition and strategy because he really wanted to understand if all the work he had done with Fortune 500 companies could still be translated into the new dot-com economy. So he rewrote the entire curriculum and had brand new cases. And a case that stuck out for me was one where he compared Dell versus Compaq. Both were PC manufacturers who did very well at that time. You know, currently Dell still exists. Compaq was subsequently bought out by Hewlett-Packard. And he said, look, you know, we can sit here and we discuss the case and we come up with like, oh, Dell had these cells and just-in-time delivery, et cetera. And he's like, look, at the end of the day, everything has to translate into dollars and cents. So look at the P&L of both these companies side by side, and you can figure out exactly where the competitive advantage of Dell was coming. And that was coming in through the fact that they did not have to carry inventory. And when you sell hard assets, your inventory carrying costs are a big part of your P&L. And if you have less of it because they were doing just-in-time building and just-in-time delivery, all of a sudden you have more margin. And this is exactly what Bezos always says, which is, look, your margin is my opportunity. Because then you can choose to use that margin in whichever way you want to use. So it was really amazing to see, you know, the stalwarts of strategy, like, you know, he Professor Porter advises governments and, you know, prime ministers and presidents all around the world and CEOs of Fortune 500 companies being able to translate and show the timelessness of his work and his theories and apply to any business sense. And then of course the, you know, the richest or the second richest man in the world right now, effectively paraphrasing what I learned in that classroom and creating a giant company like Amazon from it. So I could go on about many other such examples, but those two, you know, have been quite relevant for me in my work.
It's people like that and stories that just come together at a place like Harvard where you get to see and experience so many different things from different people that it's just a wonderful place. And I'm jealous you had those experiences. I look forward to the next 2 years where I get to have mine. And
I'm guessing you will have even better experiences because, you know, the school is becoming so much more multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary, and the students who are coming in are much more diverse and, you know, have a much more global perspective and, you know, have a lot more pursuits than we did 20 years ago when I was in school.
Very true. You kind of answered the question we were going to ask you next when you mentioned Professor Hightower and a couple other professors who impacted you a lot in your time here, but was there any piece of advice that you really wish you'd listened to more than you did? Something that just clicked a couple of years down the road that you needed to actually experience, a lesson you had to learn through pain rather than actually listening to, you know, someone trying to teach you?
I don't know if anyone in particular stated this, but, you know, as I reflect back on my time, and this is true, and, you know, I have two daughters now, and they are your age group. They're in their early 20s. And as young people, we always, especially high achieving, ambitious young people, you always have a plan, right? Like you want to know what's coming next, and you are always doing things today in order to meet that plan for tomorrow. And I always feel now reflecting back, and I would hear this from a professor saying, you know, don't miss out your present in pursuit of your future. And I think, you know, that's a very deep statement that I'm synthesizing across multiple things I heard. And it didn't quite sink in for me at that age, but it is very true. If we spend our entire life planning for tomorrow, we kind of forget what today is all about. And, you know, realistically, what we ought to be doing is forgetting the past, living the present, and anticipating and celebrating the future. And if we live our present through our values, then our future self would never incriminate our past self, right? Because that's one thing we can never regret, which is we live by our values. But we can always regret not doing all the things that we thought we ought to be doing at the time that we ought to be doing them.
That's really great advice. At Harvard, many students, if not all, are driven, hardworking, smart, and know exactly what they want to achieve. But what do you see that makes a successful career, not just when they graduate, but 10, 30, 50 years down the line?
I don't believe there is any one formula for success. And the definition of success, I think, also changes as people age and the circumstances and their context change. So I think we have to keep in mind, this is back to Professor Hightower's advice, which is you never have complete information to make the right decision at that point. And you also should be willing to adapt and be flexible about the decisions as you get more data. So similarly, as our circumstances change, our definition of success should obviously also be flexible and adapt according to the circumstances. The one thing I have found in my life anyway is that openness to serendipity has been a very important part of being content. And I believe that being content is more important than being happy, because happiness, I think, is ephemeral and it's very transitory. Being content is a state of mind, and it lasts a lot longer. And it is important to do that. And if you have a fully fleshed out plan that, you know, talks about every little thing you need in life, then even if some parts of it don't happen, you feel that there's some shortcoming or that you missed or you failed in some way, shape, or form. It's like that, you know, you got an A, but with 99, what happened to that 1 point kind of thing? Versus when you open to serendipity, it's like, yeah, I got an A, and by the way, I didn't get 98, but I got to play intramural soccer and made some great friends and maybe, you know, met my future spouse there. That's probably worth a lot more, right? But that was never in the plan. So being open to happy circumstances and happy surprises, I think, is important. You may or may not know, I just announced 5 days ago on Monday that I'm retiring from SoftBank later this year. And the first question everyone asked is like, oh, where are you going next? And I'm like, I haven't decided. I don't know. And they're like, how is that possible? And, you know, the reason it's possible is because I don't feel like I need to have a plan for every little thing or every big thing I do in my life. And some interesting opportunity will come along. I just felt it was time for me to, you know, close this particular book that I've been reading for the last 6.5 years and contributing to. And then, you know, I'll create and open a new book later. And I did the same thing when I left LinkedIn in 2014. Again, my only plan was to spend more time with my daughters who were in high school at that time. And that worked out fabulously. And then this opportunity to go become an investor, which I'd never done in my life before, came up serendipitously. It just worked out. So, and you know, serendipity seems to imply that it is chance, but I think serendipity is not chance. You just need, if we allow it to happen in our lives, we will have more happy serendipities. But most of us don't allow it to happen. We don't leave room for serendipity in our life. So that's what I would advise people is, you know, look, again, everyone who comes from such august institutions as Harvard is very smart, is very ambitious, is very driven, is very hardworking. We can't guarantee that we will be the most ambitious, the smartest people in a room. We can usually guarantee we'll be the hardest working. But along with that, if we leave a little room for chance and for happy chances to occur in our lives, I think we'll be positively surprised.
You know, I don't even know how to answer because it's something that I've spent a lot of time thinking about, and you put it in better words than I ever have. So I'm a little bit jealous.
I probably have 30 years on you. And fair English enough. Is my second language, so I have to really think about what I'm saying.
So, and this wasn't in our script, but I did want to ask, what motivated this, you know, your decision to move on here? Why now? Why at this stage in life are you going to spend time with your daughters again? Do you have a plan to just enjoy the serendipity, as you put it? Are you going to see what comes next? or, and you don't have to answer if you don't want to.
I'm very intentional about big decisions in my life, and leaving an amazing platform like SoftBank, all the phenomenal colleagues that I have around the world, a team that I helped build and a fund that I helped build from the ground up alongside a visionary like Masa, it's not an easy decision to make. At the same time, I also know that I love being a principal. I'm an entrepreneur at heart. I love building businesses and I want more agency in my life. I know I can be a good investor in the right circumstances. I'm very grateful for SoftBank to have taught me that and given me that belief in myself that I could do this at a professional level and deploy billions of dollars very productively and generate tremendous returns for our LPs. I now want to do it with more agency and more freedom to operate. And so I felt it was the right time to do it. And I had long discussions with Masa over several months, and we both agreed jointly that this would be the right thing for me to do.
Fantastic. I'm a little bit jealous that you've realized that about yourself. You've given something to the company, and you've also learned from the company. That's an important relationship to have in life, and something I aspire to one day. So moving on from that, you're wearing your LinkedIn.
Most constructive relationships are symbiotic. They are never one-sided.
True.
Whether in life or professionally, personally or professionally.
Moving on from that, I'm sorry to interject with that question, but so, you've got your LinkedIn shirt on, so we have to ask, from your time there, what do you think about social media now, just the space in general, in terms of utility, entertainment, and just how new platforms are vying for users' attention on a daily basis?
It's a great question, especially given how much technology has overtaken our lives, and especially in the last 18 to 24 months, when many of us, our social interactions have reduced, in-person social interactions have reduced even more. Technology has become a much bigger part of our life. I have the following belief, which is successful and popular technology platforms are just a manifestation of our physical lives, of our non-electronic lives. What technology does is it amplifies the magnitude and increases the frequency of our non-electronic life. So, if you go back to the days when you were a teenager in high school, like we all had our insecurities. There were the popular kids, there were the jocks, there were the nerds. I shouldn't say nerds, I should say the intellectual types, and everything in between. But whatever interactions, social abnormalities that existed in that microcosm, whether it was a 60-person high school or a 600-person high school or a 2,000-person high school, kind of stayed there. And we would have, great experiences with our friends, and we would have not so great experiences with people who, chose to play out their insecurities on us. And once we got home, we were with our friends because we could choose who would be with. We'd play, we'd work together, and, life sort of balanced out. Unfortunately, now with social media, that is amplified because now we are friends of friends. So it's no longer limited to your 600-person high school. Maybe it amplifies to 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 people that are in that social network. It's always there because we are carrying the device with us. And all of a sudden, every waking moment of our life is dictated by how we feel about those interactions with other people. And not all of them are pleasant ones. So it creates magnifies the amplitude of our anxieties and insecurities in ways that none of us would have ever realized. So we can clearly blame technology for it because it is the medium through which this is amplified and increased. At the same time, what it is doing is it's not generating necessarily new human behavior. It is taking that and projecting it in much bigger ways. And we haven't taught ourselves, we haven't taught our younger selves. This is not limited, of course, to high schoolers. I'm just giving that as an example. We haven't taught the teenagers, the adults, the older folks how to deal with this deluge that comes our way. So I still remember when my kids were in middle school, they had a visit from the local police department. I'm like, oh, what did they tell you? They're like, well, you know, when you go on the internet, you have to be sure that you know who we are talking to. Just like we don't talk to strangers outside, we shouldn't talk to strangers on the internet because, you know, they may feel nice and they may say nice things, but they could be bad people, right? So they were taught about online safety and security the same way policemen have been coming to elementary schools and middle schools in this country for a long time, teaching kids safety in the playground, teaching kids safety when they're walking home from school and vice versa. So they came and taught the basics thereof. But the school counselor or nobody else is teaching the kids, well, how do you, you know, the same way that you may have good and bad experiences inside your classroom, on your playground, what happens to you in the online world? Because we are not equipped to do it and haven't paid attention and focused on it. So that is the controversy that we are facing today. I think technology is a medium. It can do amazing things for us and it can do very bad things for us. Unfortunately, we have let it get out of hand by virtue of not being very thoughtful and intentional of how, not just how should we use this technology, but also how should we teach everyone around us in society to say, look, we now have a very powerful medium on our hands and how should we be deploying it for our good so that it does more good than it does harm? Because right now in some segments of society, it's doing a lot more harm than good.
Those are some really great insights. Thank you for sharing these questions. Students often build companies with great ideas, but what have you seen amongst leaders and company culture that separates successful investors from founders?
So, you know, I think three things are necessary. They are necessary ingredients to build a company that has the potential to be successful. A great idea, a great space in which you are deploying that idea, meaning, you know, what is the problem set that you're solving and how big is that? And the third is great execution against that vision. But that's like, you know, having all the necessary ingredients to bake an amazing cake in my pantry. I have it, and so does, you know, an amazing pastry chef you may know. Well, my cake probably will not sell for $200, but, you know, Christine from, you know, the TV show, who has all those pastry shops around New York, like her cakes will sell for $200, right? Not mine. So what is that fourth magical ingredient? She has that magic. She has the creativity and the art of making that amazing cake. Similarly, I think the best companies have the magic of culture. And that's what founders really focus on building from day one. Because, you know, good ideas can be copied. Execution can be bought. Markets are what the markets are, but culture is something that you have to instill, and it is very, very special, and it is very, very individual. And the strong companies that endure all have strong cultures. Now, they could be good cultures, they could be bad cultures, you know, that's in the eye of the beholder. But having a strong, great culture is a very important ingredient. This is why I think companies like, you know, Google and LinkedIn and others endure the test of time. And people are mission-driven, they're values-oriented, they have high integrity, they make the right decisions for their users and their customers. And all of that is instilled from the get-go. You can't, it's not like icing on the cake to make it sweet, like the sugar has to be in the batter. You can tell I love baking because I'm giving you all these analogies about baking. But
I mean, my last name is Baker, so I felt like I had to learn how to bake over quarantine.
What's your favorite thing to bake, Alex?
Butterscotch oatmeal cookies. Best recipe I have. It's fantastic. I'm a little biased there, but...
Next time I'm in Boston, we may have to take you up on it.
Absolutely. Give me a ring. So moving on from there, as some of our audience might not know, you spent some time at Stanford as a lecturer. Was there a particularly rewarding moment or a realization once in your first lecture hall, sitting there looking at your class or interacting with these students who were looking up to you for the first time as a professor instead of being in the chair looking up at your teacher? What was that like?
Oh, it is intimidating. I was like, holy cow, these students are so much smarter than what I remember me being or my classmates being back 30 years ago. You prepare extra hard. You know, you think of the 10 different questions they may have about the same topic. It is, the quality of students, as I was saying earlier, and the experiences that all of you bring into the classroom today is just so much richer than we used to 30 years ago. And you're not shy about showing it in a very respectful, thoughtful manner in the classroom. So I felt like every single class I taught, I probably learned more through the questions. And I believe a lot in the Socratic method of teaching. So I rarely ever lectured. I would more pose questions. And our class was also about learning about doing. It was a class on product management, and people had to build products as the final project for the class. And it's phenomenal. I still keep in touch with the students. In fact, early next week, I'm talking to one of my students who graduated 3 years ago, and she is going through a career change and in product management, and she wants some advice. That's amazing, right? I mean, just like I gave you examples of Professor Hightower and Professor Porter, and the impact they had. And, this could have been just like one of the things they said in class. That's what I took away. If you ask my classmates, they may have taken other things away. But it impacted my life in a very meaningful way. If I can even do 1/10, 1/100th of that for any of my students, that feels very fulfilling. And that's what I aspire to do with my teaching, is how do I pay it forward? I've had great teachers, and I hope I can be one one day as well.
Reflecting back on your time at SoftBank, what did it teach you about how to categorize types of VC investments? Not necessarily by stage or industry, but maybe by potential.
SoftBank is a very unique platform. We are multi-asset class, multi-category or multi-domain and multi-geography investor. And I like it because great ideas come in all shapes and sizes, and they all have certain common ingredients that we talked about earlier. So I focused at SoftBank on life sciences, enterprise software, and frontier tech investments, which is a very broad swath. But as I said earlier, I'm a very intellectually curious person, and I needed that breadth of opportunities to go pursue in order to be excited and have fresh thinking, and you can bring this thinking from one area to another. So it's a very unique platform. I think more firms are going in that direction. Used to be that investment was, someone's only an early stage fund, someone's only a growth equity fund, someone's a private equity fund, someone's a credit fund, someone focuses only on consumer, some people only do enterprise, et cetera. And there is some value to specialization, but I think there's a lot more value to synthesis across these asset classes and stages and geographies to bring to bear. We are increasingly global as humanity. What happens in China impacts us here, as we all know, but ideas move very fast from one geography to another. Learnings are deployed and absorbed very quickly. And as investors who need to stay ahead of the pack and deliver above average returns, we have to stay on top of it.
It just makes perfect sense. I'm not really sure how to follow it up. It's just that clear cut and simple. But we would fail our listeners if we didn't ask you about your favorite startups and investments. Do you have any particularly memorable stories that just stand out as either fantastic decisions or regrettable mistakes that you may have either missed an investment or one that you wish you hadn't made?
We all have our share of things we wish we had done exposed. But again, I always feel like if you live by your values, then your future self does not regret your present self. And similarly, I have a set of principles in terms of how I make investments. And as long as I follow them, I'm like, of course, I will miss some huge, huge thing, but did I also find other huge things? Because I don't have to invest in every big thing, I just have to invest in many big things, right? As Jim Simon from Renaissance famously said, he's like, look, our algorithms are make sure that we are right 50.5% of the time for a few days. And it's that extra half percent and the few days is where we make all our money. So similarly, we have to be right more often than wrong, even in the private investing business. And you know, hopefully you deliver above average returns. Out of the 36 investments, you know, trying to pick a few, obviously is like picking amongst my children, and I don't have 36 of them. It's still hard to decide which one I like more. So it's not that. Let me share with you an example of something that I'd always heard about before I came into the investing world, but now I've seen in action, which is you tend to make, you tend to make more money or outsized returns in investments that are contrarian or most controversial within the firm, where it's not a consensus that, oh, this will be a good investment, like go ahead and do it. And one of those was my second investment that I made for the fund called Guardant Health. They were doing, and they still do, liquid biopsies for cancer detection. So it's a very new and unique method that they were one of the pioneers of. Rather than doing solid tumor biopsy and doing surgery to get a piece of tissue out of a body, of a human's body, they just take, some blood and they run it through a genetic screen and, they are able to find mutations in cell-free DNA that is circulating in your blood and figure out if you have any cancer or not. And it's great because you can do it more often because it's only taking blood as opposed to doing tissue biopsies. It's cheaper than doing surgery, clearly. And it is great for people who may be living in fear of remission. So, if someone has breast cancer and they are doing their annual checkups, the most dreadful phone call they get is from their doctor, which says, we should talk. Because then they worry that things have relapsed, right? We may have all heard those stories from our friends or family or people that are near to us. So Guardant helps with all of that. When we first invested in them in 2015, end of 15, early 16, somewhere around that time frame, it was not very clear that A, this was the right method, and then B, diagnostics companies usually don't become very big. The history of diagnostics companies in the US because of payer issues and reimbursement issues was that they become $1, $2, maybe a $3 billion company at best. You don't see the kind of bump up. The technology, was good, but there were other competitors. And so we had a lot of questions internally about it. And I was very convinced about the team. I was very convinced about the opportunity they were going after, which I believe was very big. And the TAM was not just that particular diagnostics, but all the other things they could do, which have now been proven. Very psyched about the culture that they had fostered in the company. And, I pushed hard to make a fairly large investment at that time, maybe one of our larger investments in a private company of $300 million. That has ended up being an amazing investment for us. We invested about $600 million valuation. The company is worth $12 to $15 billion today, depending on the day and the stock. It's exciting for me, not just because it generated a few billion dollars of profit for us as a fund on a $300 million investment, but also because it really showed me that if you have a set of values which are grounded in data and history and judgment, and if you stick by them, eventually things do work out for the best. So that's how I started forming my investment principles. And that's what I continue to use every day. That was my second investment for 34 investments after that. Thankfully many of them have gone on to do great things for the fund. 36, we've now had 8 IPOs, 2 M&As and 2 SPACs, one of which went public this morning, actually on the New York Stock Exchange. It's borne out. And that's why that's one of the children I like to talk about. It's as favorite as my remaining 35 children, but it I think makes multiple points for other aspiring investors.
You've spoken a lot about your principles. Do you mind if I ask you to expand a little bit on what exactly yours are?
There are a few. One is, you know, only invest in a company if you are willing to put in 5% of your own net worth into that company. I take my fiduciary responsibility towards the LPs very, very seriously. And, you know, the money that we get from our LPs is really pension money and, you know, someone's social security check or, you know, fireman's fund and policeman's fund and, you know, university endowments that, you know, give scholarships and tuition assistance to needy and meritorious students. And I take that very seriously, and so does the rest of our team. And we always ask ourselves the question, like, if we bring this to IC for an investment, are we going to put 5% of our net worth in it? And what that means is that, you know, the second principle or the preamble principle to that is only invest in exceptional companies or what we think are exceptional companies, right? We wouldn't know ex ante, but you see enough components thereof. The third is speed and quality of decision making. And I saw this firsthand when, as an entrepreneur, I started a company while I was in business school and then came out to the Bay Area after getting funding from VCs here. And the one thing I found was I really appreciated getting quick decisions from potential investors. Because the one thing, you know, there are two things an entrepreneur doesn't have. The first is money, which is what the investors can provide. The second is time, because we have so much on our plate. Like, we are trying to solve all these things. And if an investor just keeps stringing you along and give me this and give me that, or I'm not sure and I need to do more work, when they already kind of know the answer, that's not cool. And so we always focus on speed and quality of decision making within the firm. And, you know, it's okay to say no. Like, we say no more often than we say yes. That's just the nature of our business. And I don't think entrepreneurs hate us for saying no. I mean, they may be, you know, displeased for a bit, and it's disappointing, no question. But the way you do it and, you know, being constructive and helpful even while saying no is very important. So those are some of the principles. You know, of course, I look for strong teams with good culture. That hopefully by now is very evident. That integrity and the human aspect of investing matters a lot to me.
Thank you so much for sharing. Moving on to our favorite last question. What is your hottest take or most controversial opinion? Not necessarily something we've talked about, but something interesting.
Great question. And, you know, when you say that, when whatever take you have, chances of it being wrong 5 years from now when we reflect on it will be very high, obviously. So with that, and given that, you know, we encourage our entrepreneurs to take risks, I'll take a risk also of, you know, of being wrong, perhaps with a 90% probability. I think that the world is looking at AR, VR in a very incorrect way right now. And that's a technology that has the potential to completely change our experiences in many different ways in a fundamentally positive way. And I'm shocked that no one is thinking like that or has come up with applications of AR and VR. The technology is good. It's not amazing, but it's very good and it can do many things. I'll give you an example of this. So we talk about access and we talk about privilege a lot in our country, right? And look, all of us on this call, by virtue, you know, not just of our resources necessarily, but by virtue of the institution with which we are affiliated, our privilege, let's face it. You get to, you know, learn from Nobel Prize winners. You get to learn from the smartest minds. Your peers are amazing. You know, you have strong networks. The possibilities and opportunities you'll get in terms of recruiting will be better than just about any other educational institution in the world. You know, I've done well by virtue of my, you know, beginning with my education and then my experiences. I grew up in a 200 square foot apartment with no running water and no toilet in the heart of Mumbai. But it was my education that you know, bootstrapped me out of that as a person who was the first person to go to college from his household, and now who's encouraged, and I've become a role model for all my nephews and nieces who've all gone on to become and acquire professional degrees. So education's played a big part in our privilege, right? All of us, and helping us get to where we are. How do we bring a lot of those experiences to people? And, you know, it's not just digital access, but it is like a full 360 degree experience. What if, you know, we could build AR and VR experiences, and it's very easy to do, it's not that hard, where, you know, that kid in Sao Paulo, Brazil, the kid in Mumbai, the kid in, you know, Kandahar, Afghanistan, you know, Jakarta, Indonesia, could be in the same classroom as you and learn and interact and experience. What if that kid, when, you know, you took your trip with your friends backpacking in Yellowstone, could be with you and experience the enormity of the great outdoors that this country has to offer, when all they have seen, like I had seen, was a 10 kilometer radius from my 200 square foot apartment, because, you know, we couldn't travel anywhere. When you see the possibilities of the world has to offer, it automatically magnifies your ambition. When you experience the richness of the knowledge and wisdom that the classrooms of Harvard offers, it automatically, you know, amplifies your ambition and your desire to learn and your desire to contribute to the greater good of society. What if we could use this to really see what happens in the smokestacks, you know, north of Beijing, when the coal mines fire up, the coal-powered power plants fire up in the middle of winter and the entire city is covered in smog. That's when you see the effect of climate change, like in front of your eyes, right? It's not the same as seeing it on TV, but experiencing it in virtual reality. So I think this technology has power to change our mindsets, to increase opportunity for everyone around us, and to really level the playing field. And what are we doing instead? Like creating new shoot 'em up games? You know, creating new entertainment experiences of a roller coaster ride and like getting that thrill. I mean, that's interesting, but that's like, you know, I don't know, that's like kindergarten stuff when we could be using this technology for so much more. So I think we are missing the whole point on AR, VR, and, you know, hopefully we do better there. How's that for a hot take that's going to go cold in 5 years?
Amazing. Thank you so much for sharing.
Yeah, wow, that was a fascinating take on the question. Most people assume that we're asking, you know, what do you think about pineapple on pizza, or...
Which I love, by the way. I love pineapple on pizza with jalapeno. It's the most amazing set of toppings ever.
And that's the bottom line. Thank you so much for listening. If you like this podcast, please be sure to find us online at harvardventures.org. If you're a company or individual interested in working with us, email us at hello@harvardventures.org. And follow us on Instagram @harvard_ventures. Tune in next week for another episode of The Bottom Line.